Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On the NewsHour tonight, the United States and Venezuela agreed to a prisoner swap, bringing several detained Americans home.
Colorado's Supreme Court disqualifies former President Donald Trump from the 2024 primary ballot, setting up a high-stakes legal battle.
And Israel continues ground operations in Gaza and puts a one-week pause in fighting back on the table as families of hostages plead for their release.
We need to pressure them harder to make this agreement and to release my father and others, because we don't have this time to wait. Any day can be his last day now.
Welcome to the NewsHour. In a high-profile prisoner swap, 10 Americans are heading home tonight after the U.S. freed a top ally of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Six of the Americans were judged wrongfully detained by the U.S. State Department.
As part of the deal, the Maduro government also agreed to free 20 Venezuelan political prisoners. And a fugitive defense contractor, Leonard Francis, will be returned to the United States. He fled before sentencing in a massive bribery scandal involving the U.S. Navy. President Biden, returning to the White House tonight, took questions on the swap.
Why is it okay for the U.S. to be negotiating with the Maduro government and sending back people in Justice Department custody?
It's okay because we've freed American people who were held illegally, and we made a deal with Venezuela that they'll hold free elections. So far, they've maintained their requirements, and that's it.
For more on the significance of this deal, we turn now to Jonathan Franks. He's an expert on crisis management and has worked on the successful release of several other Americans detained overseas. John, welcome back. It's good to see you. You represent one of the families of the Americans freed today, 38-year-old Savoy Wright. What can you tell us about the timing, about why he and the others were released today?
You know, thanks for having me. I'm not sure exactly why today came. I mean, I imagine just the negotiations came to a conclusion. But this is obviously a great day, both for my clients and that Savoy is back, and also for our whole hostage community. I mean, I think we lost four or five families today out of Bring Our Families Home campaign, and I'm really excited about that because that means there's five more families that have been made whole.
What else can you tell us about some of those negotiations? We know Savoy was held since October, I believe, right? He was the most recently detained American, but the others for much longer. What can you tell us about what happened in those negotiations over time?
Honestly, I'm not privy to it. I mean, I've got to give the administration credit. They've done an amazing job. This is a historic deal. I think that they, those who say that this was a tough decision to send Mr. Saab home, don't know much about what Mr. Saab was accused of, or the collateral damage that prosecution caused. A 10 for one deal, 10 Americans for one plus 20 Venezuelan souls is a heck of a deal. The president had a moral obligation, and I'm proud of him for doing it.
So what about that businessman, Alex Saab? I'm sure you've seen there are some folks criticizing the deal. This is a man who was awaiting trial in Miami on federal money laundering charges, right? He's a supporter and an ally of the Maduro government. There are those that say this exchange incentivizes foreign governments, especially adversarial ones, to take more Americans hostage because it means they can free their allies and friends. What do you say to that?
You know, it's a complex situation. There's no actual evidence that is true, that it incentivizes more hostage taking. But, you know, obviously, I concede that it logically follows. I think what we have to keep in mind, right, is Mr. Saab was a white collar criminal. He's a Colombian national that allegedly stole from Venezuelans. Right. He was arrested in the Cape Verde and we extradited him. There were real world consequences to that decision on hostages being held in Venezuela. It turned the Maduro regime into the leading collector in the world of American hostages. So I think there's, you know, it's a double-edged sword, right? In a sense, we incentivized a lot of hostage taking by taking Mr. Saab. And, you know, I don't think that bringing Americans home today incentivizes more hostage taking.
What about Leonard Francis? We know he's more widely known by his nickname, Fat Leonard. He's behind a $35 million bribery scheme. It's the largest corruption scandal in U.S. military history. As part of this deal, Venezuela is returning him to the United States. What does that part of this negotiation tell you about the deal?
I think there was a desire to clear the decks, right? And Mr. Francis, or Fat Leonard, or as he goes, needs to face justice for what he's done. It's my understanding he's already convicted, so you know, he needs to face responsibility. So I think it's another positive to this deal and a piece of it that perhaps the administration isn't getting credit for.
Finally, we mentioned earlier six of the Americans freed, including your client, Savoy, were deemed wrongfully detained by the U.S. government. That means four of the other Americans who were freed were not deemed wrongfully detained. What should people understand about that? Does that mean that their detention in Venezuela was justified?
I think it doesn't necessarily. It just the process to be designated wrongfully detained is difficult. And in countries like Venezuela, the government often prohibits defendants from getting copies of court documents, and it is really hard to provide the kind of documentary evidence that is necessary to qualify for designation under the Levinson Act when the person holding your loved one, you know, refuses to provide you even one document. We didn't even have a charging document in Savoy's case.
What else can you tell us about how Savoy is doing today or his family?
As the last time I talked to his family, they hadn't heard from him yet, but they are incredibly excited. It has been a difficult several months. And when I entered this case, this family was being actively extorted for a very healthy five-figure sum. And, you know, they're just, nobody was there to help them. I've very much enjoyed getting to know his family. I can't wait to meet Savoy. He sounds like a fascinating guy. And I think, you know, if he's guilty of anything, it's falling in love with Venezuela.
It's a good day for that family and many others. John Franks, thanks for speaking to us tonight on this historic prisoner swap between the U.S. and Venezuela. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
It's an historic court decision that could have a major impact on the 2024 race for the White House. A divided Colorado Supreme Court has ruled that Donald Trump is ineligible to serve as president under the Constitution's Insurrection Clause, and it barred him from that state's primary ballot. The ruling sets up a likely showdown at the U.S. Supreme Court. The ruling by the Colorado Supreme Court was the first to say that Donald Trump's efforts to overturn Joe Biden's 2020 election victory disqualify him from running again. Under a post-Civil War era provision of the Constitution that bans insurrectionists from holding public office. The justices pointed to Mr. Trump's own words in his speech at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th.
We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
Attorney Eric Olson argued the case for Mr. Trump's removal from the Colorado ballot.
So I'm very proud to be a Coloradan and an American today, because this is what it means to have the rule of law, where you're given a fair shake.
Four of the court's seven justices, all appointed by Democrats, upheld the finding that the January 6th assault on the U.S. Capitol was an insurrection, that Mr. Trump engaged in that insurrection, and that the 14th Amendment's ban on insurrectionists holding public office applies to the former president. They wrote, because he is disqualified, it would be a wrongful act under the election code for the Colorado Secretary of State to list him as a candidate on the presidential primary ballot. The dissenting justices argue, absent a conviction, it's up to the federal government, not the states, to determine who is an insurrectionist. Justice Carlos Samore wrote that a patchwork of state rulings risk chaos, concluding, this can't possibly be the outcome the framers intended. Republican reaction from the campaign trail was swift.
I do not believe Donald Trump should be prevented from being president of the United States by any court. I think he should be prevented from being president of the United States by the voters of this country.
There was no trial on any of this. They basically just said, what, you can't be on the ballot? Could we just say that Biden can't be on the ballot because he let in 8 million illegals?
The ruling in Colorado stands in contrast to challenges to Mr. Trump's eligibility elsewhere. Courts in Arizona, Michigan, Minnesota, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Florida found in the former president's favor. as cases in other states are still playing out. The Colorado ruling will be placed on hold until January 4th, pending Mr. Trump's appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, which could settle the matter for the entire country. To discuss the ruling, we're joined now by constitutional law expert and former acting U.S. Solicitor General Neil Katyal. Neil, welcome back to the program. So the Colorado Supreme Court ruled that under the Constitution's insurrection clause, Donald Trump has forfeited his right to run for president again. In your estimation, did that court get it right?
I think the court did get it right. I mean, it's obviously a momentous holding. It's a very solemn day. In many ways, it's a horrible day because we shouldn't really be here in a situation in which the courts have to come in and say someone is disqualified for, of all things, being an insurrectionist. But that is, after all, what the 14th Amendment to our Constitution, added in 1868, says. And, you know, people like me kind of would much prefer to beat Trump at the ballot box. But our founders did have this absolute constitutional requirement that you can't be an insurrectionist, just like you have to be 35 years old and a natural born citizen.
When this question came before the Minnesota Supreme Court in November, the Chief Justice there raised the concern that there would be chaos, that some states keep Trump off the ballot while others allow him on. And she asked the question, should we do it even if we could do it? How do you see it?
Well, that would be a good argument, I think, in 1868 to maybe say the 14th Amendment shouldn't say what it says, but the truth is it does. And I don't think these kinds of policy concerns should really inform ultimately what is a constitutional question. You know, I think at this point, Donald Trump had his chance in Colorado to try and say he wasn't an insurrectionist. He lost that. And given that finding by the Colorado trial judge and, you know, Trump's own attempts to try and delay any sort of criminal adjudication into the question, I think the finding that the Colorado Supreme Court made yesterday is right.
And the Colorado Supreme Court, as we reported, they delayed this ruling taking effect so that Donald Trump can appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, which is seen as the inevitable arbiter as to whether the 14th Amendment applies to him. How quickly will the court take this up?
I think the court can act very quickly. I mean, in Bush versus Gore, which I was involved in, it was about 36 days start to finish. I think the court here can act on a similar timetable. Right now, they actually are in their winter recess with about 6 weeks off with no oral arguments at all. So I think they can be ready to go.
Is there anything in the dissenting opinions from the Colorado Supreme Court that would be of interest to the conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court?
Most of it is not actually of interest, Jeff. Most of it's about Colorado state law and what it means. And they disagreed with the majority that you could go into Colorado court and make this kind of action. But when it goes to the United States Supreme Court, that court can't second guess Colorado Supreme Court's decision about matters of Colorado law. So you only have some of the arguments Trump was making, which weren't persuasive to the Colorado Supreme Court, available in the U.S. Supreme Court. The argument that he's not an officer of the United States, which is just textually absolutely wrong, or that he hasn't been adjudicated in a criminal case guilty of insurrection, which I think is also wrong. I mean, this is a Supreme Court, Jeff, composed of strict constructionists, people who look at the text of the Constitution, and the text of the Constitution is as clear as day. Insurrectionists can't hold office, and presidents are officers, and the text of the Constitution basically just says, you know, this is an ironclad requirement, and it's got to be enforced.
Well, a question about that, because Donald Trump's political fate now rests with the court that he helped shape. Is success for him guaranteed, given that three of the justices on the court right now are justices that he appointed and helped shift that court to the right?
Oh, I think that's absolutely the wrong way to look at this. I mean, first of all, historically, the United States Supreme Court is often in these situations. Richard Nixon's case about executive privilege had three of his own appointees on it, but it was an 8-0 decision against Richard Nixon, which ultimately led to his impeachment. With Donald Trump, this is the court that rejected in 2020, time and time again, of Donald Trump coming before the court to try and say there was election fraud and the like. It's the court that rejected his executive executive privilege claims and sided with the January 6th committee 8-1 in a decision last year. And it's a court that in Moore versus Harper, a case that I argued about the Republican independent state legislature theory, threw that out on a 6-3 vote as well, despite people like John Eastman pushing that theory. So this is a court that is very much capable of doing the right thing. And here, when the text of the Constitution is so clear and doesn't have anything like, oh, you got to be convicted in order to be subject to the 14th Amendment, I think it's a very hard case for Donald Trump's lawyers.
Neil Katyal, always appreciate your insights.
Thank you.
In the day's other headlines, the European Union announced a breakthrough agreement on new, tougher rules for migration. It came after overnight talks in Brussels and after a major influx of asylum seekers in recent years. EU leaders hailed provisions to share the cost of hosting migrants and to mandate screening of all arrivals at the bloc's borders.
Today, with this historic agreement, we are opening a new chapter of a Europe of migration that we want to be proud of. Every member state has issues that need to be addressed on a comprehensive, holistic European migration policy. Everyone's concerns need to be recognized, acknowledged, and addressed.
Opponents of the pact argued it will weaken the rights of migrants and lead to lengthy detentions of minors. Meanwhile, lawmakers in France approved greater powers for authorities to deport foreigners deemed to be criminals or undesirable in other ways. It's subject to a final review before becoming law. Security and logistical challenges in Congo caused disruptions in today's presidential election. Almost 44 million people were expected to vote amid chaotic conditions. Crowds grew agitated after poll openings were delayed for hours in the capital city of Kinshasa, and smudged ink on voting cards slowed the process. As a result, balloting will be extended until tomorrow. In England, so-called junior doctors began a three-day strike against the National Health Service. It's part of a long-running dispute over better pay. Doctors in the early stages of their careers are demanding a 35% hike to account for inflation. The government is offering about a 9% increase. Back in this country, new vehicles had a record high fuel economy rating in 2022, averaging 26 miles a gallon. The Environmental Protection Agency credits electric vehicles and hybrids for much of that increase. It says the improvement came despite rising sales of larger, heavier SUVs over sedans. And on Wall Street, disappointing corporate profits stopped the ongoing rally in its tracks. Major indices were down 1 to 1.5%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 476 points to close at 37,082. The Nasdaq fell 225 points. The S&P 500 dropped 70. Still to come on the NewsHour, Congress leaves for the holidays without reaching a funding deal for Ukraine and the southern border. Pilots and air traffic controllers warn of growing burnout in the airline industry with risks of a major disaster. We examine the nationwide shortage of workers who support people with disabilities, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The top leader of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, was in Cairo today speaking with Egyptian officials who are one set of mediators in talks that could renew a deal for a ceasefire and hostage swap in Gaza. In the meantime, Israeli operations in Gaza continue. The death toll among Palestinians, according to the Hamas-led health ministry, topped 20,000 people there since those terror attacks of October 7th.
The Security Council has agreed to continue negotiations today to allow for additional time for diplomacy.
For the third day in a row, the UN Security Council delayed its vote on a bid for a humanitarian ceasefire with hopes of avoiding a U.S. veto. Earlier, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the U.S. was working to, quote, resolve outstanding issues in the resolution.
The purpose of the resolution, as stated by the countries that put it forward, is to facilitate and help expand humanitarian assistance that's getting into Gaza. And we fully support that. In fact, the United States from day one has, I would argue, done more than any other country to make sure that that could happen.
Advocates for a ceasefire say time is running out for humanitarian aid to reach the Palestinians who need it most. In a grim assessment, UNICEF now estimates that each displaced child in the Gaza Strip has access to just 1.5 to 2 liters of water a day, far less than what's needed as a bare minimum for survival.
This is not life. We already lack electricity, water, gas, food, and drink. We have nothing.
Just north of the Egyptian border, clusters of tents for the displaced now resemble sprawling city blocks. The backdrop to the crisis on the ground in Rafah, huge plumes of smoke. An Israeli airstrike here forced dozens of people to flee for their lives, the youngest ferried away in ambulances. In Khan Yunis, children cling to their parents inside hospitals crowded with the injured. And outside, overwhelmed with bodies being prepared for burial. Yesterday, the IDF called the southern city the, quote, new city of terror, and today released this video from the north, showing a spiral staircase leading down to a massive network of underground tunnels. They claimed it runs directly into the homes of several Hamas leaders, including Yahya Sinwar's. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu insisted that a ceasefire is not up for debate.
We continue the war until the end. Those who think we will stop are not connected to reality. We will not stop fighting until we achieve all of the goals we have set, the elimination of Hamas, the release of our hostages, and the removal of the threat from Gaza. We are attacking Hamas with infernal fire.
Meanwhile, in the Red Sea, Houthi leaders threaten to target U.S. warships if the U.S. fires towards Yemen.
We will not stand by idly if the Americans are tempted to escalate further and commit foolishness by targeting our country or waging war against it. Any American targeting of our country will be targeted by us.
The rebel group also warned countries not to join the U.S. coalition aimed at countering attacks on commercial vessels as well as stunting a wider regional conflict. Back in Israel, months after October 7th, families of hostages held in Gaza still wait in agony. A pause could lead to another round of hostage deals, as videos released by Hamas this week sparked hope their loved ones were at least still alive.
Joining us now is one of the family members with a loved one still held hostage. Noam Perry's father, Chaim Perry, is 79 years old and was one of the three men featured in a video released by Hamas alongside 84-year-old Amiram Cooper and 80-year-old Yoram Metzger. We are not showing the hostage video as part of our editorial policy. Noam joins us now from outside Tel Aviv. Noam, welcome back. It's good to see you.
Good to see you also, Hamna.
So what was it like seeing this video, seeing your father in this way?
First and foremost, I was so happy to just see him and know that he's okay and know that he's alive. It's the first time that I saw him since October 6th, and even if it's within this video, it was really great just seeing him.
How did he look to you? How did he seem?
He doesn't look good, to say the truth. He looks thin and tired and not himself. He looks sad. It was hard to see him like this.
And did you have any idea this was coming? I mean, how did you find out about the video?
No, just saw it in the media. Actually, Hamas sends it out on Telegram, so it's just out in a minute, and we didn't have any prior notice.
Your father speaks in the video. He shares a message. Obviously, this is under duress. We should stress that. But he does talk about being abandoned. I wonder if you understand that or if you share that sense. Do you feel like the hostages who are still there have been abandoned in some way?
I don't take the content of this video as I'm sure my father has not said it in his own words. So I don't want to use any content of this video. But I can say that it's obvious that we cannot accept that a person like my father or his friends, that an 80-year-old man kidnapped from his home and being kept more than 70 days in tunnels in Gaza. It's unacceptable in any way.
It has been more than 2 months, as you mentioned, and you've told me before your father relies on medication. He is, 80 years old. What is your sense among the government officials you talk to of why it's taking so long?
I don't have an exact answer for this. I know it's complicated. I know Hamas doesn't necessarily want to release these hostages and keeps them as bargain for his own needs. I'm aware of it. Everything needs to happen together to allow his release. And yet, I say again, it can't continue like this. I don't know how many days my father can survive in his age, in his health conditions. You know, I heard just a couple of hours ago President Biden and others saying it's not going to happen soon. And I can't accept it. I can't accept it. So if the sides are not willing to compromise yet, so we need to pressure them harder to make this agreement and to release my father and others, because we don't have this time to wait. Any day can be his last day now. We're so thankful for President Biden and the U.S. government for being so deeply involved and committed, but we generally ask to do even more and to pressure and to make my father come back even before Christmas. We don't have any time. We don't have any time left.
Noam, I have to ask you, too. I know there's talk of a possible pause, but meanwhile, the war does continue, and there's a war that's being waged in your name, in your family's name, in your country's name. The death toll in Gaza is nearing 20,000, mostly women and children, and I just wonder how you process all of that as it unfolds.
We talked before, and you know that my father is a man of peace, and this is how I grew up, and I definitely would not want to see any war coming. But again, we need to remember that we haven't chose this situation. My father was at his home. His friends that were slaughtered in Iroz were just living their life there on October 7th. We didn't choose any of this. So we can't continue the situation as it was before, that's clear. I wish that we had a solution that does not include this kind of bad results for all sides.
Noam Perry, joining us tonight from outside of Tel Aviv. Noam, it's always good to see you. Thank you. We're thinking of you and your family.
Thank you.
After returning to Washington for a day in hopes of reaching a border deal, the U.S. Senate instead decided last night to close up shop and head home for a holiday break. This means critical work and tough debates over Ukraine funding, Israel support, border security, and keeping the government itself open will all get jammed into what looks to be a very intense January on Capitol Hill. Lisa Desjardins is here with me in studio to make sense of it all. Hi, Lisa. Good to see you.
I don't know if I'll make sense of it exactly.
We're going to do our best here. Well, you've been making sense of and covering all the ins and outs of the border negotiations all week. What does it mean that we're still not at a deal yet?
This is a Rorschach test. There are a couple ways to look at this. You could say they haven't been able to come up with a deal. But you can also say this is, as the negotiators like to say, the most complicated area of U.S. law. The fact that they're still there shows the determination, not just of the negotiators, but the leaders. Let's look at who was still meeting in the Capitol today. It is DHS Secretary Mayorkas, along with the three senators, Democrat there, Senator Murphy, Independent, Sinema, Republican, Lankford. They have decided now not to do in person for a few days. They're going to continue to meet virtually so they can go home, celebrate the holidays, all of that. But I think it's clear what they're up against. We're seeing this surge at the border. You've covered it. We've been seeing this coming. Now thousands of migrants a day at the border and problems in U.S. policy that was not equipped for this. So they're tackling nothing less than perhaps an incredible rewriting of asylum policy, to name other things. So it makes sense it's taking this long. However, they are going to be jammed up against the calendar in January. They wanted a deal by now, and they don't have it.
So what about January? This does kick a deal into January. They have other deadlines that they're facing. What does the timeline look like?
I, as you know, and our viewers know, have seen many intense months in Congress. I really have not seen this kind of stack of major issues coming together at one time. It is a basic calendar nightmare. Let's look at what's ahead. So January 8th, that's when Congress returns. Then after that, their first deadline if for government funding, January 19th, that is when funding for Ag Department, housing, veterans runs out. Then there's a second government funding deadline coming up February 2nd. So while they're trying to process this border deal, they also have to figure out how to fund government in two separate deadlines. And oh, Amna, by the way, what else is happening? How about the presidential elections? January 15th, Iowa caucuses, and the 23rd, the New Hampshire primary. So think of it this way. The Senate generally needs a week and a half to do anything because of its calendar. Mm-hmm. They're going to come back within 2 weeks, already have a funding deadline, and they're trying to, accomplish the biggest immigration deal in perhaps 20 years at the same time. It's really hard to get my head around how they do this, but they're say they're going to try.
Meanwhile, as you know, all of this is unfolding with fairly new, relatively inexperienced Speaker of the House in Representative Mike Johnson. How critical is he to moving all of this forward?
He is a linchpin because obviously you need both chambers to agree. And he is the head of not just any Republican conference, but one of the trickiest Republican conferences in modern history to navigate. He has members of his conference that are ardently for parts of Ukraine aid, parts of the border deal, and some who are ardently against it. And underneath all of this, as he also tries to negotiate spending, above him hangs that sword where any single member of the Republican conference can still move to oust him from his job. His job is on the line in these major tasks that they are now squeezed into a few weeks to handle. What's more, it's gotten even harder. Why? The former Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, has resigned. He leaves office officially at the end of this year. By leaving, that means their very slim margin is now even smaller. George Santos, also a Republican, now out of office. So essentially, they've got three votes, one way or the other, that they can spare. And all of this is something that this brand new speaker, who's never been chairman of a House committee, has to figure out in a very short period of time. The stakes are incredibly high. It's hard to see how he navigates it, but he has to. And there has to be some kind of bipartisan deal, I think, on all of this for it to succeed.
Busy January for Congress and for you, Lisa Desjardins.
We'll be here.
We hope you get some sleep. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It's been described as the airline industry's silent struggle, the issue of pilot mental health, which was pushed into the spotlight this fall when an off-duty pilot was charged with trying to crash an Alaska Airlines flight from inside the cockpit. That pilot later told police he hadn't slept in 40 hours and was experimenting with psychedelic mushrooms to help deal with depression. Earlier this month, the National Transportation Safety Board held a full-day summit devoted to mental health in aviation. And commercial pilot Troy Merritt shared why he sought treatment for depression despite the potential cost to his career.
I found myself no longer able to function on a day-to-day basis and ultimately no longer fit to fly. And that's when I knew I needed to take the next step to address my health. For many, including myself, the choice to use an antidepressant can be a very difficult one. It was especially difficult because I knew what was ahead of me. I faced months to years out of work navigating the complicated certification process to get my medical back and the possibility of being told I could never fly again. These prospects only worsened my anxiety and depression and made an important personal health decision even more difficult.
We're going to talk more about this with Jennifer Homendy, who chairs the National Transportation Safety Board. It's good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
And we should say that Troy Merritt, the pilot we just heard from in that clip, he says his treatment has gone well. He hopes to begin flying again soon. But so many pilots say the system is broken. The FAA relies on them to self-report mental health issues. But so many pilots are afraid to do that for fear of losing their licenses. That presents a major safety risk.
It does present a major safety risk. A lot of pilots and air traffic controllers and others in aviation have reported that it's work or seek help. You should be able to seek professional mental health care while still being able to retain your job. And we're talking about losing loved ones, going through the divorces, just the stress of jobs. And it's usually, at least for the pilots, fly or get denied.
And pilots who do seek care say they face long waits, expensive evaluations to prove that they meet the FAA standards of fitness. And they say the process to get back in the cockpit is opaque. How actively are you working with the FAA to modify its position and this process while also maintaining safety?
Well, I'm very encouraged by the FAA's formation of a rulemaking committee to look at the issue, but I hope there is action. I have had a lot of conversations with Mike Whitaker, and the Secretary of Transportation has been very supportive of mental health care and has said some great things with respect to pilots and others in the aviation community. So I hope that we are headed in the right direction to some help for others.
There are more demands than ever on pilots right now. What particular pressures and stressors do pilots face?
Oh. They have a extremely stressful job. I mean, they have safety in the skies. They have so much on their shoulders, not to mention everything that they face in their personal lives. And we expect pilots to be superheroes, as if they don't need help during their most difficult times in life. They should be no different than you, me, say a locomotive engineer who's also responsible for the safety of others, surgeons and others, where they are able to get the care that they deserve.
Do you also worry about overtaxed and potentially stressed out air traffic controllers, especially given the uptick in the near-miss collisions as reported recently by the New York Times?
I do, and we know this is occurring right now just from our interviews alone and recent investigations on runway incursions. We have a shortage among air traffic controllers right now. That shortage has led to mandatory overtime for a number of workers. We're talking six-day work weeks, supervisors that are doing controller jobs. They aren't able to receive the training that they should be able to receive right now because they are on duty all the time. That leads to a lot of stress. It leads to fatigue. And so, you know, I get very concerned about the impact on each of them.
Changing what it means to need mental health care in aviation, transforming the process is one thing, but it strikes me that this requires sort of a wholesale cultural shift. Am I right in that?
It does. It does. And we have to really look at the research out there and know that aviation is no different here. We know that stress impacts others. We know how prevalent mental health needs are. We know that one in five people have a mental health condition, and we know over 50% of them are not able to seek care. And so we know in aviation that they should be able to seek help, and we know that early intervention ensures safety for all.
While you're here, I also want to ask you about Tesla, because Tesla, as you well know, it's recalling nearly all 2 million of its cars to limit the use of its autopilot feature. And this follows a two-year investigation by safety regulators of roughly 1,000 crashes in which this feature was engaged. How big a problem is this, and why didn't regulators catch this on the front end?
Well, how big a problem is it? It's 2 million vehicles, to be exact. But this is a problem that goes back to 2016, when we investigated a horrific crash in Williston, Florida, and we said right then that this technology leads to driver disengagement and that NHTSA had to take it seriously, that Tesla had to take it seriously, and they had to address it. Here we are 7 years later, and NHTSA's came up with the same exact conclusion that we came up with 7 years ago after several investigations and several deaths. So, you know, if they had acted sooner, I think that would have prevented some fatalities, but, you know, here we are, and hopefully Tesla is taking this seriously.
Is there a way to prevent that in the future? That's the same thing where, you know, something you spotted years ago is now finally being addressed?
This happens a lot. We issue safety recommendations after our investigations and just recommendations aimed at preventing that tragedy from reoccurring. And sometimes we're ignored. And sometimes we're ignored far too long. One recently that was implemented was ignored for 50 years. We need action, whether it's Tesla or any other vehicle manufacturer or entity, to ensure safety.
NTSB Chair Jennifer Homendy, good to see you.
Thank you very much.
They are the largest workforce in the United States. The nearly 5 million direct care workers who support older adults and people with disabilities. But despite high demand, many are paid little more than minimum wage. As Judy Woodruff reports, a long-standing workforce shortage means people with disabilities who depend on those workers to live independently and access their community are left without the support they need. It's part of our series, Disability Reframed.
For the past 14 years, Luciana Offley has been by Tyler Corkin's side. The 33-year-old has cerebral palsy and autism. He mostly communicates using sounds and hand gestures.
Got some good bacon?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tyler depends on Luciana, who goes by the nickname China, for nearly every part of life in his Maurepas, Louisiana home.
Feeding him, transporting him back and forth out of his chair, bathing him, giving him medication, his medication, and just, you know, keeping him comfortable.
So you do pretty much everything for him.
Mm-hmm. And I also, you know, wash his laundry, make his bed. Yeah, I do a lot.
She says the most rewarding part of her job is exploring the community with Tyler.
You're getting excited.
No.
Who loves music and being around others.
Just being able to take him out and just, you know, doing things with him is entertaining for him, and it's, you know, it's getting a chance to get out and be around people.
But for each hour China is with him as a direct support professional, or DSP, she's paid $9. She works 7 days a week, and even with overtime pay, still has to hold a second job to support her family.
There's a shortage of people who do the work you do, direct support professionals.
Yes.
Why do you think that is?
Because they're not paying enough. That's why they're leaving. It's, you know, no benefits, not enough pay. You've got to have a heart, you know, to do this kind of work.
What's the hardest thing about it?
Just being away from my family is the hardest.
There's been a national shortage of DSPs like China for decades, largely because state officials have limited Medicaid funding that helps cover their wages, and career advancement has been difficult. The national turnover rate for DSPs is more than 40%, with rates reaching over 50% in some states. Advocates say a lack of investment in Medicaid nationwide drives the problem. It is the largest funding source for the services that many DSPs provide. In Louisiana, those who hire DSPs say there is simply not enough money to pay them more. Those employers are expected to cover a range of costs that include wages, health insurance, and training, typically paid for by Medicaid at rates that state officials ultimately decide.
2 years ago, the Louisiana state legislature allocated the money that allowed for a $9 an hour wage floor for direct support professionals, a workforce that helps to sustain some of the more than 1 million people in this state with disabilities.
It's hard to find people to come and take these difficult jobs when you have a rate that low. So we need to get the rates up to make it more competitive.
Louisiana Republican State Senator Franklin Foyle has family members with disabilities, including a son with autism and a sister with Down syndrome. From Louisiana's capital, Baton Rouge, Foyle has pushed to increase the state's Medicaid rates and for DSPs to be paid more.
What do you think it would take to persuade some of your colleagues in the state legislature that they needed to improve the Medicaid reimbursement rate in Louisiana?
You know, I think part of it was there was always a pushback because it would cost more money. It's an easy issue to sell once you explain to people and give them the real life experiences to get them on board. But it does cost money, and when you have a limited funds, you have to allocate. But this, in my opinion, it's not an option. It's something that we have to do because these people have no other way, in many cases, to get the support they need.
This is it.
This is it.
80 miles southeast in New Orleans, 26-year-old Jaquil Abdullah has seen the DSP workforce shortage firsthand. Abdullah was diagnosed with bipolar disorder in high school
and has chronic back pain after a surgery left him without feeling in his right leg. He uses a cane to get around the city and the community college where he takes classes in game design.
When I wake up, I know I'm disabled. I can feel the pain constantly.
He says he's struggled to find a direct service worker, or DSW as they're known in Louisiana, to help with basic physical needs, including personal hygiene and transportation to school and social activities.
Finding someone you can trust to come into your home and put your life potentially on the line, to have them around you daily, it has been a struggle that makes me not even want to live here, honestly.
Abdullah also thinks there should be an increase in hourly wages and that all DSWs in the state should go through a certification program.
I've had DSWs tell me this is more of a resume filler or a stepping stone to more real work, such as working in hospitals and nursing homes. No one wants this to feel like a part-time job or it's not a career.
Over 1,000 miles away in Brooklyn, New York, 25-year-old Fatima Howard is just starting her career. The mother of three was hired as a DSP in January. She works in a day habilitation program where people with disabilities attend exercise classes, volunteer, and visit community sites. Today, they're going to the library. It's where Fatima and her co-worker Nate teach a sign language class so their group can learn to communicate with a deaf peer.
Exactly. I love to do it because I know that they appreciate me and that they look for me to be here every day. So the days I'm not here, they call my work phone to ask if I'm here, like, am I coming, when I'm coming back. They depend on you, and I let them know that they can really depend on me or whatever they need. I take it seriously, I love it.
Does that surprise you that there aren't enough people doing this?
I mean, it doesn't surprise me because companies like this are underfunded and the people who make decisions on how much we get paid doesn't see it. They don't play the role that we play every day, so they don't know how much work we actually do. Which is sad for the people we support because they love their staff. They want to continue to have the same staff, not just people come and go.
In her spare time, Fatima takes courses as part of the eBadge Academy, a DSP certification program. She says it gives her the chance to refine her skills.
It makes a difference because you learn how to provide ethical support, and that's important. You learn about the safety, you learn advocating with and for the people we support and making sure they advocate for themselves as well.
These are professionals that are doing professional jobs and providing that credentialing and career pathways so that people can continue to grow and develop their professional skills in our field.
Carrie Neufeld is the commissioner of the New York State Office for People with Developmental Disabilities. Last year, her office partnered with a DSP advocacy group to offer credentialing to those who do this work in New York State, and bonuses up to about $2,000.
What's happening for our providers is it's changing the culture within provider organizations. It's letting staff know that OPWDD, the state, the providers respect the work that they're doing, treat DSPs as professionals, and want to see them succeed.
Back in Maurepas, Louisiana, DSP Chyna Offley says she doesn't always feel that respect for her work.
Chyna, what would you say to people who don't understand how hard this work is and who are not sure if more money should go into paying higher wages?
I think they know. They know that we should be paid more. It's just that they're not giving it.
Money, she says she and so many other DSPs need, that allow people with disabilities to more fully live their lives and be part of their communities.
How would you describe your relationship with Tyler after all these years?
Well, he considers me his person. He really does. Don't you, Tyler? Yeah.
So he considers you his person, and what do you, yeah, how do you think of him?
Well, I really consider him as one of mine, actually.
And she says she'll keep caring for Tyler as long as she can. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Judy Woodruff in Maurepas, Louisiana.
The songs and sounds of the holiday season are upon us. NewsHour digital associate producer Tim McPhillips reports on a concert that celebrates one booming brass instrument.
It wasn't the famed Rockefeller Center tree, the dazzling windows at Saks Fifth Avenue, or the Rockettes at Radio City Music Hall that brought hundreds of people out in a downpour to celebrate the holiday season in New York. It was the tuba. This year marked the 50th anniversary of Tuba Christmas, a yearly gathering of enthusiasts who play the season's favorite songs exclusively on this booming brass instrument.
They've come from all over the country. I have people who have driven here from South Dakota, from Minnesota, from Virginia, North Carolina. There are close to 300 Tuba Christmas events across the country and around the world. But this is the granddaddy of them all. This is where it all began.
Michael Salzman is the coordinator for New York City's iteration of Tuba Christmas. This Tuba Christmas is his 49th.
I started playing the tuba for the same reason that most tuba players did, because the band needed a tuba player.
To the untrained ear, it may be hard to recognize the tuba as the steady bass of a song, or the important anchor to a harmony.
We really help make things run. We might not be the flashiest, but we're definitely, you know, the foundation.
When he started Tuba Christmas, famed tuba player Harvey Phillips wanted his instrument to have its own moment in the spotlight. The tradition began in 1974 as a tribute to Phillips' own tuba teacher and mentor, William J. Bell. The event now happens in places like San Francisco, as well as hundreds of others around the U.S. and the world, like Honolulu, Costa Rica, Vancouver, and Washington, D.C.
It's amazing. These people bring in their little children, 11, 12-year-old kids here playing in the ensemble. What it means to them? Oh my goodness.
Chris Wilhelm has been the New York City Tuba Christmas conductor for 20 years. Rehearsal starts just hours prior to the show, when tuba players of all ages and experiences do a quick test run.
We have just a few minutes to rehearse. Yeah, I guess you could say it's a little bit of a challenge.
After rehearsal, the players swarm Rockefeller Plaza, decked out in their finest holiday styles, showcasing the tuba's unexpected range.
It's really such a very, very beautiful sound. We equate it to a big, warm hug.
And while the weather outside was frightful, to those in attendance, Tuba Christmas was still delightful. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Tim McPhillips.
Like a big warm hug. Thank you, Tim. Remember, there is always much more online, including tips for dog owners about an unidentified canine respiratory illness that's been reported in more than a dozen states. You can read about that at pbs.org/newshour.org.
And join us again here tomorrow night when we have an interview with George Clooney about the new film he's directed called The Boys in the Boat. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us.